Hi there, and welcome to the third episode of Fresh Sounds Open Ears. My name is Alex Eddington. I'm a Canadian composer and a music educator, and I am constantly finding ways to intertwine these two things, hence this podcast. Today we're going to be talking to Canadian choral composer Katharina Gimmon. And before I talk about her a little bit and we start our interview, I just want to do a little bit of housekeeping. So we are now findable in quite a few more places. I've been busy getting the Fresh Sounds Open Ears podcast out there on the web. So you can follow us on Instagram at @FreshSounds_OpenEars. So that's one word, Fresh Sounds, underscore, one word, Open Ears. On Twitter, we are at @FSOE_podcast. We've had our Facebook group, or Facebook page, sorry, for a couple of weeks, and that is facebook.com/Fresh Sounds Open Ears, all one word. In terms of listening to this podcast, our home base is still anchor.fm, so our anchor page is Fresh Sounds-Open Ears. You can also find us now on Google Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, Podcast Addict, and a few more apps. We're still waiting on Apple Podcasts. Apparently, there was a bit of a snag, and then maybe a snag on that snag in terms of getting these things up. So that's right. We've been live for a month since our first episode and still not quite distributed everywhere, but we'll sort that out soon. If you could do me a big favor, if you've been listening to the podcast and enjoying it, please subscribe in your favorite app or two. And even more importantly, if you could just take a moment to review the podcast, give us a star rating, just tell us what you think. That would be fantastic. Also, I am sharing episodes and quotes from episodes and audiograms from episodes on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And I would appreciate it if folks chimed in. Tell us what you like about the episodes. Comment, like, forward, repost, whatever pertains to the particular social medium you are in at that moment. Something new I'm going to start doing is putting the thank yous for the podcast closer to the beginning, because I never know who's listening all the way to the end, and also because sometimes it's nice just to end with music flowing right out of the interview. So in terms of thank yous, first of all, the big one goes to the Alliance for Canadian New Music Projects. That's the ACNMP, who are the presenters of this podcast and who had the idea for it in the first place. I've been on their board for a couple of years, and this project has something we've been stewing about, and finally it's great to have it going. I'd also like to thank Steph Chua, who is working for the ACNMP and is my main contact there, has been really helpful. And she designed the very first version of our logo, which I recently edited to add the additional two words, Fresh Sounds, Open Ears. Our theme music is by Saman Shahi, and he did a fantastic job with that. So thank you very much to those people. If you want to hear more about what the ACNMP does, I talk about it more in my first episode. You can also go to their website, acnmp.ca. Now, in the past two episodes, when we talked to Laura Hawley and then Dean Burry, I kind of read from their bios at the beginning, but that's a little bit dull, and I think it's better if I post that and you go and visit their websites. And these composers do a great job of introducing themselves and talking about their own work. So I'm just going to kind of give a summation of some of the amazing things that Katharina Gimmon and I talked about today. First of all, Katharina Gimmon is a composer I guess we'd call newer generation. She's younger than I am. She's in her 30s, I believe, and she is really building a fantastic career as a choral composer and specifically as somebody who is known for having a very collaborative approach and for writing music that performers can kind of bring their own interpretation to a certain degree. And you'll hear us talk about that quite a bit, about the aleatoric elements in her music. We also talked about R. Murray Schafer as a big influence on her. We talked about the little songs about food that Katharina sang as a five-year-old. We have some visits from her cats, which is always exciting. We talk about the Hamilton Children's Choir, the kind of music we write during COVID, how to have a sense of hope that keeps singers wanting to be in choirs and wanting to keep singing during this time. We talked about how to involve singers, young ones and adult ones, in the creative process, creating text and creating music for her pieces. And finally, then we talk about Regina Spektor, because of course we do. So enjoy this interview. It was really delightful to talk to Katharina, and I'll pop in a couple times to explain and define a few things.
Mm-hmm.
You live in Vancouver, right?
Yep. Right now I'm living in Vancouver. I moved out here in 2015, it would be. I came out to do my master's, and I'm originally from Burlington, which is not too far from Toronto. Grew up, lived there, sort of did my music education all around there. And then, yeah, I sort of said to myself, oh, I'll just go up for 2 years, do a master's in Vancouver because I know nobody there. I knew nobody. I'd never even been to Vancouver. I had been nowhere past Calgary, but I was like, let's do this. And I fell in love with the city. There's so much choral music here. There's so many fantastic people. I love the music scene. And I haven't gone back yet. We'll see. So, yeah.
You know, I was thinking of going to UBC or UVic for my master's. Mm-hmm. And I went on a train tour. I had been accepted at both, but hadn't said mm-hmm. yes. And I went to UBC and met up with Stephen Chapman. And had a chat with him, and there were a series of names written on the board of people who had already accepted to go there for graduate degrees, and there was a big mark next to my name, and they're like, you know, but I on the way out there, I visited a friend in Edmonton for a week and kind of fell in love with U of A and like the very smaller program there and the grittiness mm-hmm. of the city, and I was like, you know what, this is like 24-year-old me, I think the West Coast will make me soft, and so I. I want to go to a city that feels like a tough place to live, which Edmonton in a funny way did, just because I knew knew fewer people, and it's less pretty in a way. It's beautiful in other mm-hmm. ways. So
this was your master's, you said?
For my master's, yeah.
Yeah.
And then at that time I was thinking I would go somewhere bigger, a bigger city, a bigger school for a doctorate, but I never did a doctorate. I probably won't now. Oh, really? You were thinking of a doctorate?
I was originally thinking, yeah. I mean, it was part of the reason I went out further is because I said, oh, I'll go out further away from my family for the shorter degree, and then I'll come back and maybe go to U of T for my doctorate. And then I was like, actually, I don't know if I want to, you know, teach at the university level. I actually really just love, you know, like freelance composing and being my own boss and everything. So it worked out, and at least for now, I'm going to do this.
This is fair, and I wish there were easier ways to study composition at a high level without doing an advanced degree.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I like to chip away at it, and I don't have 6 years to invest in.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, I feel like I'll probably talk about this later in the podcast at some point, too, but I really have the mindset of being, you know, like a lifelong learner. I feel like even though I've been out of school, I've still been learning. I've still been doing professional development. I'm still always, you know, researching music, analyzing things, looking at things. So in a way, I feel like the time since my master's has been my own doctorate in a way, because I've already learned so much in that time just on my own. But it's very specialized learning because I know exactly what I want to learn. I can reach out to those specific teachers. I can do my own specific research and everything. So it's like a do-it-yourself doctorate, I'll call it, if I can put that next to my name at some point.
I'm just popping in to say we missed a really great opportunity here to make a joke about a PhDIY. Totally get it. Yeah, like I do project-based research and reaching out. And, you know, I have some things on hold because of COVID right now, but like currently I have books about hurdy-gurdies and modern recorder techniques.
Oh, that's so cool.
That I've had from the U of T library for a year because they closed down people returning things.
Mm-hmm. Lucky but, you. Yeah. You get to keep it now.
That's true, although I haven't cracked them in 6 months. But the focus of the podcast that I'm doing this season, at least, is composers who work with younger and less professional musicians, particularly writing for them or even with them in a collaborative approach. And that's something I know you've done a lot of. Mm-hmm. And I want to sort of delve into some specific projects later, but why don't you just start by telling us in like a pithy sentence, how would you describe the music you compose?
That is the hardest question, I feel like, for a composer, but I'm going to do my best. I feel like my music is pretty eclectic, I would say, you know, if I had to choose one word to sort of start out with, but also very evocative and emotionally rooted, I will say. So it's far reaching. I have a lot of influences from a lot of different places, but I'm very interested in, you know, connecting to human emotions and evoking something in my music, if that makes sense. So that's why I chose those words.
Oh, it does make sense. Yeah. Because, I mean, you can use any techniques you want and influences mm-hmm. you want in the service of composing. But when there's that core
is it if it's a text or an emotion or something, there's something there for the performers to really hang their hats on as they dig into it. Is that why you do it, or is it also just what inspires you?
Both. I think it's why I do it. It's also what inspires me. I mean, a lot of that, I think, I sort of can trace back to my early like start. When I started composing, I came sort of from an avenue of a songwriter first. And I think that approach sticks with me because everything I do is very intuitive. You know, I use my voice first. I tend to improvise. I tend to move to actual, you know, writing things on a paper, putting it in notation software a little later, because my process became very rooted in actually using my own voice, my own instrument, and my own body, as well as things that I'm very connected with personally, because it started out always being me being the performer, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So when I stretched into the composing world, I always kept that. It's always things, you know, the things that I'm writing music about are things that I'm really curious about, things that, you know, I've gone about daily life and I see something in the news, or I see a poem or a piece of art or something that really inspires me. So it's a little biased, but I sort of come at my music in that way. I really want something that really moves me, because I know if I feel that, it's much more likely that I can make the people that are performing it and the people that are seeing it feel that as well. And that's, for me, that's what it's all about. So.
Mm-hmm. And it's in that way, it's both for the performers and for the audience, or is there like a blending between them? Like, you want the music to kind of speak to both in the same way, whether they're singing it or hearing it?
I think it's for both. I mean, the thing about the performers is I want, a lot of the time in my music, I involve things, maybe this is a bit of a separate thing, but I guess somewhat related. I tend to involve a lot of aleatory or little elements of, you could almost think of it like customization of a work. And I think this is something that you do as well too. And so I try and not only sort of put a little bit of myself into the work, but leave space for the performers to sort of customize it and put themselves into the work a little bit as well. So I almost see it as a joint effort, even if we haven't met, even if they just got the score from me or something. I like to think that their performance of whatever work it is unique, and me, but also them. And I think that's what makes things moving and authentic musically.
Okay, I should really pop in here and try to define what aleatory means and aleatoric music. Some people, like me, say aleatoric music. Basically, these are sections in a score or whole parts of a score where the notation doesn't tell the performers exactly what to do, but leaves some of the parameters open to them. So it might be that it tells you what notes to sing, but not when to sing them. Or it might give you rhythms, but not tell you what notes to do. Or it could be something that's just an image, a graphic, and you have to interpret it your own way. So there are lots of different ways to do this, but as Katarina is talking about, it gives the performers freedom. Especially if they know what emotion or concept you're trying to access, and you give them the means to kind of get their best route there with the, you know, within the parameters you've set.
Exactly.
Do you feel like you get a more committed performance with aleatoric sections than you would if you scored everything?
100%. Yeah, I think so. I mean, maybe it's just the people that I'm working with, but I mean, especially I find, honestly, even with just younger, more amateur musicians, so much of the time they are just like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. This is new. This is fun. You know, I get to just play. Like, it's literally just like play.
For sure.
Yeah.
Totally. And it's, you know, sometimes I find if I create a piece through play, like through a workshop process, I'm really reticent to then put everything down on paper as like set. I'm looking for ways now to like keep them playing in performance, and aleatoric notation can do that. Does this ever transpire into a workshop process for you? Like, do you go in or you know, beam in virtually right now and help singers through your scores? Do you demonstrate? Do you or do you just make sure that your scores have clear enough instructions that they with their music director can make the aleatoric music happen?
Yeah, I mean, I try to, like, for all my published music, I do try and make sure that all the instructions are clear enough, or like maybe I'll make a video or something, and that tends to be fine. I do have some people that, you know, I mean, I think are still afraid, you know, some people are just afraid of composers that they think they're going to do it wrong and the composer will be very sad at them. And I tend to, like, for most things, when people come at me, they're like, oh, can we, like, I don't know, add this little thing over top, or do you mind if we recite something, or do you mind if we change the body percussion slightly? And I'm like, honestly, as long as it fits the intention of the piece, like, please go for it. And just some of the emails I get, they're just like so carefully worded, and they're like, would you be okay with it? We don't want to, you know. And I appreciate that, but it is sort of funny the fear sometimes people have of composers.
when I was an orchestra librarian and personnel manager and general sort of helper, I wrote to a couple of composers who were not pleased that we were asking if we could perform half a movement, you know. So sometimes people, maybe they've had bad experiences. But also, I think we tend to think of composers as being right, being correct.
Yeah, and they give the instructions, and the performers are just the interpreters, which I think from my approach and from what I can tell from yours as well, too, we're very much not that. We are sort of like a vessel to help them express the things they want to express, or at least that's what I see from my own music. I sort of give them the tools, and I want them to be part of that as well. So I don't see as clearly defined, I think, as, you know, maybe traditional classical music, where it's the composer who like almost sits in their cave and just like hands out this little score through a crack in the door, whenever.
Yes, and then
the performer's
direction.
Yeah.
And somehow the music's supposed to speak for itself, which we all know it doesn't, because, you know, classical scores rely on performance practice. Mm-hmm. You have to understand what, you know, what, how things were played then, because it has changed through time. Mm-hmm. What I find liberating about notation now is being able to create and define graphical elements that give the performers freedom, and then just use the English language to explain what you want. And there's a real art and science to that, and you'll still get questions, but you don't need to depend on the performers knowing how to do it already.
Exactly, yeah. And that was one of my favorite things. Like, I remember a defining moment for me sort of growing up through my musical education was the first time I saw the scores of Murray Schafer when I was in choir. And it was the first time I'd really seen graphic notation. And I'm a very visual person, like visual learner. And so I just, the rest of the rehearsal and like every time I wasn't singing or learning my part in choir, I was just like looking at the score and thinking about what it could be and imagining things. And that was a huge turning point for me, and just thinking about how I could explore those things on my own. So I'm very biased, but I love that. I thought it was so cool.
He's an interesting one, because some of his scores, the graphics are there to create an atmosphere, and sometimes they're very specific about what they want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the atmospheric elements were, I think, the parts that I connected with the most, was the way that you could convey something. Because, I mean, something as simple as, I have a piece called Fire, and there's a section that people seem to really like where I just basically said, improvise some shouts and calls over top of this. And I could have just said that in words, but then I have this image of a flame with, you know, like these little things coming out and everything that gives you a sense of, you know, the energy and the spirit that I actually want there. And that's something I always explain in workshops when people ask me about that piece and why did you put that element there? And it's because I feel like it helps very quickly convey more than the fact that I just want you to, you know, make some shouts and calls over top, which I could just write those words, but then you're missing that energy and that atmosphere. So that's the part that I really liked.
So at this moment, we had a little bit of an interruption, some disturbance in my house, and it got us talking about having kids at home versus having cats at home. Anyway, that explains why we start talking about cats.
Oh, yeah. No, I've had that happen in a couple of workshops of mine. This one, I have two cats. So this is Pico behind me. You can't see. There's a bit of sunlight. So he just has like this strange halo right now. But he's pretty good. He just sits there all day. And then like, you know, like lunchtime, he will do a 180 turn and roast himself on the other side with the sunlight. But his sister, his sister is just like, she just wants to be as close to you as possible. So sometimes she'll just be on here in your face. She's the one who gets in the camera, you know, and can cause trouble.
You have sibling cats. That's adorable.
Yeah.
No, I think cats are allowed to interrupt anything we do. It's just sort of societally accepted.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So was your first instrument the voice?
So my first instrument, actually, it's funny. I begged for so long to take voice, but I didn't actually end up studying voice until I was 11. My earliest music education was actually like a group music making class called Music Makers that I took, when I was like 3 or 4, I think I did that.
Cool.
So like pretty young, and I played, Glockenspiel, you know, metallophone, did all the percussion instruments, learned about the staff. I remember this whole story about, you know, like, oh, here's Bumblebee with his stinger in the middle and like all of those little stories they tell. So that's where I learned like all the basics. And then I ended up starting private piano lessons when I was in grade one, which would make me how old? Like six, I would say. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Six or seven.
Yeah, six or seven.
Yeah. That's cool. So you took piano first, and then how did you get from there into this kind of singer-songwriter?
Yeah, so to be honest, I mean, I had always been begging my parents since like basically I could speak to take voice lessons. And my mom's actually a musician. She minored in music at school. She's a clarinetist, did classical clarinet and jazz clarinet, went quite far. And she had a friend who was in like the jazz band that she played with, who was a vocalist. And at the time she said, oh, your daughter wants to take singing lessons. She should wait till her voice changes. Which was sound advice, but I mean, for a child, I was like, nope, I want singing lessons now. Basically,
you were like five, six?
Yeah, I was really little. Yeah. I mean, I loved singing. My parents would always basically wake up to me on the baby monitor, just like singing whatever Disney song I had heard lately, just making something up. So I just loved singing.
Did you sing with the kind of inflections that Disney songs have then, or were you always like a choral, like a pure vowel kind of choral singer?
I think I'm actually not sure. I'll have to ask my parents. I don't think I had like choral tone. I think I just sounded like a kid singing for fun, probably at that really, point.
I'm kind of surprised that a young kid wouldn't just want to sing, but would want to take vocal lessons. Because I think when kids often want to take, say, guitar, it's because they realize without the lessons, they won't learn to play. But if you already love to sing, which you did, what was it that you thought you'd get out of vocal lessons? I mean, I'm asking you to remember when you were five, but what do you think?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think I just wanted to learn how to do more. Because, I mean, at that point, I had started getting really, I mean, I'm the generation where, you know, like I was listening to Spice Girls. I was listening to like Cranberries. I was listening to like Alanis Morissette. Like a lot of really awesome lead
right in the sweet
female.
Spot.
Yeah, like a lot of really amazing women doing really cool things vocally. And I was like, I'm just a kid and I can sing these melodies, but like I can't just like, and I mean, I didn't understand at the time that like developmentally as a child, you just don't have the capabilities to like vocally do the things that those singers are doing. But I think I thought, this is what I'm guessing, going back to my five-year-old self, if I took lessons, then I'd develop my voice to a point where I'd have that vocal flexibility to like be this, you know, really cool lead singer lady.
And it could be that you know, if you showed any frustration or about not being able to sing in the style that you were trying to emulate, because your mom's a musician, I don't know, maybe she sort of pointed you in that direction.
I just wanted to learn more.
Sometimes kids, you know, just my 5-year-old is wanting to build like race cars that he can actually get in and drive, and I'm like trying to explain what kind of a learning journey that would be to get to that point and what can we do along the way. And he was very sorrowful about it because 5-year-olds just want things sometimes
they do
right away.
Yeah. So I think that was probably what I was at. And my mom was dealing with that. I can ask her later and she'll probably remember. But I think I wanted to do it. I was just so motivated. I wanted to. And I mean, at that point, I was already sort of making my own songs without musical knowledge kind of thing, because I'd like write my own little lyrics, you know, like songs about cheese. For some reason, I had so many songs about food. I don't know why. I could clearly tell you where my mind was at as a child.
No, it's everything. It's everything.
Food is everything. I had songs about bread, cheese, all the hit songs from Cat as a 5-year-old.
Do you have these recorded somewhere? Are they on
I don't,
a
but
grainy...
I do have some of the lyrics, actually. It's funny. The last time I was home, I found... So at some point, I had decided that I wanted my own art gallery. And so my the same house that I grew up in, my parents are still in. And I started hanging up like all my lyrics and drawings and everything on the garage. And to this day, my mom has not taken them down. So every time I come home, I have to groan in embarrassment as I see the lyrics for all my songs about cheese and bread and everything just pasted on our garage wall. She's like, I've never taken them down.
That is commitment. That is commitment. Wow. So how do you get from writing songs about cheese and bread to composing the choral music you composed today? Like, where was the transition to writing from writing for yourself to writing for other people or for groups of people?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, earliest was those little ditties that I was writing for myself, you know, around the time that I was starting piano and everything, when I wasn't really thinking about it too much as making music. I was just sort of like, this is fun. I like to do this. And then I had got to a point, I think, where I was old enough and had enough musical knowledge that I sort of knew what I was doing. Teenage kind of angsty years where I thought, oh, I'm just going to like write something and sing it myself. So I started experimenting at that time. And that was about the time that I had recently started singing lessons. So I started singing lessons privately when I was 11. And my singing teacher, Linda Fletcher, who's based in Oakville, she's actually a composer. She's a composer and a singing teacher. And so she had a very keen eye and ear for, I guess, people who had that creative sense and was super encouraging to me. Because before that, nobody, like, my piano teacher just sort of viewed, I guess, my piano as, you know, you're just here to learn piano. And she hadn't really thought, I guess, about my creative side. And my singing teacher was very much like, no, those are completely connected. Like at the end of your next lesson, like, why don't you show me that? And like, nobody had ever asked me. And I was always just like something I did at home that nobody wanted to hear, basically, is what I thought. And she's,
Yeah. Although your mom put the lyrics up on the walls.
Although my mom put the lyrics up on the wall, except for my mom, basically. And so she said, no, like, can you please come in and show me what you've been working on? And I was super nervous. And I remember just like, you know, playing her some stuff that I was singing over top of. And she said, hey, you know what? They just came out with a new category. And I think it was Kiwanis Festival or Rotary or whatever I was doing next. Would you like to enter it in the composition category? So that was sort of my first transition into getting a little bit more into like, okay, now I have to learn how to do written notation and how do I write this down and how do I think about it more as a composer? So I wasn't really taking composition lessons with her. I just sort of had the knowledge on my own. And then she was encouraging me to look at that world, I guess, more, more thoroughly. So I did that for a while, for a couple of years. And then I think about a year or two before I started, like before I went into university, I actually got a composition teacher and I studied with him for about a year, year and a half. His name was Philip Cork, and he was just a local teacher that I did my harmony history with, but he also taught composition. So I just sort of was like, can I also do this?
Totally.
And I wrote like little piano etudes kind of thing, explored notation. He would give me little assignments like write in this mode, you know, write a piece in this kind of style. So where I started thinking a lot more about more like a traditional composition lesson. And that was the very first time that I did that. So,
Yeah. You know, suddenly when someone takes an interest in,
yeah, like, it's huge.
What can you bring to music as a creative person? Like, yeah. What do you think would have happened if you hadn't met those right teachers?
I don't think I'd be doing what I was doing if I hadn't met my singing teacher, to be honest. And hopefully she knows that. If not, she can listen to this after. She still follows me. She's wonderful.
Yeah, definitely tell her.
Yeah, I wouldn't be doing this because, I mean, I hadn't even thought about it as a thing I could do, but she was absolutely fantastic. She would, you know, she encouraged me. She was also the kind of person who would make sure I was doing contemporary rap. Like, for example, something as simple as, you know, she saw that Nancy Telfer was like the adjudicator for the upcoming festival. And she's like, you should sing her piece. I think it was Lullaby or something like that. So then I could connect like, oh, here's this living person that I'm going to see in the flesh. And I'm going to sing their piece. And it was just the coolest thing to see like, oh, they're not just dead people who have been dead for a really long time. It's living people who are doing things now, who are writing about things now. And it's something that I could even do, you know?
Right. And it shouldn't be that hard to expose students to this, particularly with voice, right? It can be a little harder with, tuba, but the options are out there. Yeah. And, you know, here's the product placement. I mean, this is one of the niches that ACNMP fills, right? Is having a syllabus of available works by Canadians. That young people that are graded for different levels.
I wish I had seen that when I was young. I mean, honestly, maybe my singing teacher was looking at it and I didn't really know, but I think at that age you lean so much on a teacher that even just something as simple as like, hey, do you want to sing this piece by a living person? And even just looking them up, maybe nowadays you can find a video of them, is just like, wow, like sounds like a silly revelation, but like they're alive, they're doing things now, they're a cool person, you know, they go to the store just like me. They might have a cat or whatever.
I know. It's human beings.
They're
write
alive.
Music. It is It is strange. Yeah, I didn't have too much of that, partly because playing trombone, we have no solo repertoire anyway.
Yeah.
And so all of it is borrowed from Baroque music. Like, I played the Bach cello suites and stuff.
Oh, really?
At advanced level in trombone.
Oh, no.
Which is... Oh, there's a kitty cat.
Do you hear that? She's purring
aggressively. Let's just listen to the purring.
Oh, you're a really cute Gally, but you gotta go. Sorry, I'm gonna put her...
Oh, what a sweetie.
She's very...
Gally is her name?
Her name is Gally. It's actually their birthday today. They turned 3, so I think she's just really excited for her birthday, Tuna.
Their, like, actual birthday? Like, you know the day they were actually born? You're not just,
we've,
like,
decided
it
that it's their birthday. Because they were sort of found, and the vet was like, they're probably born at some point in March, and then... So I'm just deciding that this month is...
You just decided March 1st. I had a pet cockatiel who was January 13th. It's just what it was. I just decided her birthday was January 13th. So we would do a party every year. Cats are good. Cats are good. Where were we going with this, though? So, yeah, but then you end up writing... And it seems to me specializing in choral music, and particularly in choral music that gives... Mm-hmm. the performers some creative input. And also, like a lot of choral music, it's not meant for professionals, mm-hmm. right? It's meant for kind of anybody who sings at a certain level and can follow a conductor. So how did you start writing choral music?
Yeah, so I didn't actually write my first choral piece until I was in university. So my original intention when I went on to do my degree in music actually was that I would do... a music undergrad, and I thought I'd go into business because both my parents are in business, and they're like, oh, well, if you really like music, you can do it. But then, you know, you can just do an arts degree and then you can do an MBA after. And I thought, oh, okay, well, whatever.
Sure.
And Laurier had this interesting program where basically it was called an administrative option, or I think a management option, where you could pretty much tack like a minor onto any degree you were doing and like take a whole bunch of business courses, and it would be like part of your degree accreditation. So my degree is actually in, ended up being Bachelor of Music, Composition and Improvisation with a management option is what it's called.
Wow.
I know, I tacked on a lot. So technically that degree is just supposed to be if you do general music, which they call comprehensive, where they called it at that time. But in my first year, I had room for one elective and I was like, oh, I'll take composition and see what happens. And I just had so much fun. that I was like, no, I have to keep doing this. But getting back to the choral thing, at the end of that year was when I wrote my first choral piece. It's called Boundless, which is funny because people still buy it. And it was just on, like, it came out on Siren's album and it was on Adlaissa's album last year. It's been on a whole bunch of albums. Mm-hmm. People still really love it. But writing that piece was a turning point for me because I had really enjoyed writing, you know, before then I did a lot of studies as part of my composition class, you know, like 1 minute piano etude, you know, like 1 minute piece, only using one pitch, 1 minute aleatoric thing and everything. But suddenly getting to the world of choral music, I hadn't realized how much that it was actually my instrument, if that made sense.
The choir was your instrument?
The choir felt like home, like my instrument to me, because I still do feel like a vocalist and everything. But for me, I think I hadn't talked about this earlier in my early education, but a couple years after I started voice lessons, I started singing in the Hamilton Children's Choir, which is this fantastic local choir. I didn't realize that they were amazing and like this really well-known across Canada until I joined it. So that was just a lucky happenstance. I ended up touring with them, you know, across the world, getting exposed to all this music that was, you know, a lot of it super complicated. A lot of it would be considered experimental at a young age before I really knew to be... I don't know if afraid is the right word or weirded out or anything. So that just became the normal to me.
Right. And also they have an intense rehearsal schedule, don't they?
Oh, yeah. So we rehearse a lot.
It's like it's a whole world. Yeah. So, you know, it becomes the music that you do. It's it's what you're doing.
Exactly. So, I mean, I hadn't really realized how much I had just soaked up by just being part of that, like not even intentionally sitting there and being like, okay, well, what is this note? What is this, you know, score doing here and everything. Like I hadn't really been intentionally score studying or anything. It was just from my experience and knowing what I liked and drawing on those years. I had created this piece and I was like, wow, like I actually really like this. This is really cool. I think I can keep doing this. So I wrote that piece. And then in my second year of my undergrad was actually, I decided to go a little bit more ambitious. So Boundless incorporates a little bit of aleatory, but there's also a lot of like more strictly notated things. It sort of does both worlds. And so I thought, let's go far now, because I'm in music and I have the access, you know, at my university of the local choir, my university choir and everything, and they're really good. So I just smashed something. So I asked if I could write for the chamber choir at Laurier, the Laurier Singers, sure. And I wrote this piece called Elements, which is funny because it's my most well-known piece now. And I had wrote it at the time basically just wanting to explore the possibilities of what choral music could be, do something super experimental. And there was really no turning back after that because I loved it so much.
Right. Now, one of the elements is fire, right? Yeah. What are the other elements in the piece?
Earth, air, fire, and water.
And so it's a four-movement cycle?
Yeah, it's a four-movement cycle, yeah.
It seems to me that fire is getting performed kind of extra.
Yeah, everyone loves fire. And the reason why is because, I mean, like the words sort of say, you know, earth is more calm. Obviously, water, more flowing kind of thing. Air, it's air, but fire, it has this energy. And I think there's something, and this is something I hadn't realized when I wrote the piece, because, I mean, I wrote it in school. I wasn't really thinking about it being out in the world. I just wanted to write something that I thought was cool and explore what possibilities there were. But people, I guess, really like and want and need things that are very high energy to break up their program. And because that piece can be performed as a standalone and is only like 2 minutes, a little less than 2 minutes.
There's a niche for it as well.
There's a niche for it. So like I had no idea that people would just pick this piece out and just go with it. But people love it, I think, because, you know, they don't want their audience falling asleep or whatever. So they'll just bring out my piece and...
Yeah, there is something to be said for very joyful or exciting short pieces.
Yeah, I think it's just very, like I said at the very beginning, when you were asking me what my music is, it's very, you know, evocative, it's very visceral, it's wide ranging. So I don't know if you've listened to the full set, but it goes everything from, you know, like the opening is very, you know, droney, meditative, has some overtone singing, to basically like screaming and shouting, very percussive, loud, rhythmic things in fire. So it has like this very full, wide range. Water is a little more strictly notated and more melodic, so like it goes a lot of different places. I forget where I was going with that. What was the question?
Well, yeah, I find just from a project I was working on with Aviva Singers that I still have to wrap up a score for, you know, COVID. We were supposed to perform it last May, but these were like ancient stories, like Ovid's Metamorphoses, and so really like tapping into elemental, like weather things and like, so I had the choristers improvising around the idea of like earth and lightning and storms and different metals. And it's basically what you can get from that. Like everyone's got this kind of, these ideas maybe picked up from Marvel movies of like, or from things they've read or like any, for stories going back for millennia about like these elemental substances and truths, you know? So do you feel like you've tapped, are you tapping into kind of like a collective memory or something? Like,
I think so, yeah. Because I mean, one of my goals when I was writing this piece is that I wanted to create something. So the piece doesn't actually have any text in the traditional sense. It's just a bunch of syllables that I improvised, basically. And then air says the word air in a bunch of different languages. But I mean, it's not really, I wouldn't really call it a text because there's no actual poetry.
That reminds me of Armory Schaefer's piece about water, Mini Wonka, has all the different words.
I never actually sang that one, but I know that piece.
That's beautiful.
But
I haven't sung it either. No.
What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. So the piece, I wanted to try and find a way to convey something without actually using text, which seemed like an interesting idea to me. I don't know why I hit on that, but I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I could write a piece about whatever it is, and I had chosen, I think, the elements a little bit later, and people would know what the piece was about or could feel and get the sense of that, you know, regardless of where they're from, what language they speak or anything. And that idea was really interesting to me, which is part of the reason I think the piece ended up very textural and rooted, because it was about evoking those images without actually saying it. I wanted people to feel earth without me being like, this piece is about the earth, like water or whatever.
It's more powerful to leave the interpretation open and just tie into an open kind of concept that way. Mm-hmm. So these are pieces you've written for choirs that could be amateur, right? That could be choirs of almost any level, I'm guessing.
Yep. Yeah, I've had people of various levels doing these. I mean, fire, I hadn't thought about it too much because, I mean, there's actually a decent amount of DVZ with solo parts, but I've had actually like a whole high school choirs doing it and everything. The piece itself isn't actually that hard. It's just a series of loops. So once you get past the notation, which can look a little bit daunting, it's actually not too bad to learn. It's a good oral learn as well, too, as I think I've mentioned a couple other people that I've spoken to about the piece. Because of my years in the Hamilton Children's Choir, who did a lot of stuff, actually not a lot of stuff, we memorized everything.
Right.
Everything we did in that choir was memorized, and often we would have staging or movement as well. The music that I started writing, and Elements is one of those, and Fire especially, was written in a way that it could be very easily memorized so that movement could be added.
Yes, yeah. And I think also this is something you get from working with children, or with you know, amateur choirs who meet once a week anyway, is they have a long time to work on the repertoire and to really like internalize it. And if you're writing a piece that's especially memorizable, they can go to that next step where they incorporate movement or at least just really own the piece in performance. Yeah, that's great. Now, have you done any projects where you've composed collaboratively with a group, either through like a workshop session or like brainstorming, or like how have you solicited input from performers?
Yeah, so I mean, I've done a couple different things. I mean, one is I've done some lyric writing things. So since I have a background as a songwriter and have done some of my own lyric writing / poetry, I've done work with groups where we sort of pick a topic and I will lead them through like, this is going to be our structure for our stanzas, and they'll actually write the lyrics and I'll say, write me one stanza. So for example, I did a piece with the Vancouver Bach Choir. It was supposed to premiere, of course, in the spring, but it did not happen because, you know, pandemic. But it was inspired by a book. What was it called? It's a famous book. I'm blanking on it right now. It's called The Improper Princess. It's a well-known children's book where there's this princess who escapes the castle and accidentally comes across like this horde of dragons, basically, when she's trying to get out. So anyways, it's about that specific scene, the piece. And so I said, okay, let's talk about this scene. Let's read through the story. Let's say, what's the beginning, middle, end? What are the things we want to convey? And then here's our structure for our stanzas. So we want four beats. We want it to rhyme in the second line and the fourth line. How do we come up with rhymes? So like we went through all those kinds of things together, and then they submitted me a bunch of stanzas and I picked a bunch that worked well linearly and edited them together in a way that they could be the lyrics. And then I wrote the music to that. So that's
really neat.
Yeah.
Did you end up with material you couldn't have predicted by doing it that way?
Oh, yeah. They were very funny. Like, I didn't expect how funny the piece would be, but there's some hilarious ones about, you know, just like the dragons bantering, because some of them are from the voice of the princess that's like, please don't eat me. But some of them are like the dragons being like, maybe we could barbecue her and like eat her out,
eat her
for dinner later.
Well, what was the age range of these contributors?
I feel like they were like four to six, a couple probably 7 or 8, but it was a younger group, and I was so impressed with what they came up with. Like, it's a funny piece. I'm really excited. It was for a Disney themed concert, which is part of the reason I picked that story, and we went through that sort of dragon-y kind of theme. But it's a funny piece, and the lyrics they came up with, I was super impressed. It was very hard to narrow it down, but I did my best to sort of pick some from a whole bunch of different people, and I had them working in pairs, so a whole bunch of different groups basically. So they all had something they wrote in there in one way or another, but the piece was hilarious.
That's really cool. And then you get a lot of buy-in, I should think, from them for the performance.
Yeah, no, I'm a little sad that the piece didn't get to get performed last year, because now I don't know what's going to happen a couple of years down the road. It's going to be different kids.
There's turnover. Yeah, yeah. So we're having that with our Viva piece as well, which is I don't know how many of the students who worked on the piece will be there for the final piece, which affects what it's going to be. But especially when they're really young, like you're talking, time is very different for them. But it seems to me like you tapped in again to kind of an elemental theme that they can dig their claws into, right? Like kids get dragons.
They do.
And
they're awesome.
Castles and princesses for some reason. Yeah. It's just everywhere in our culture, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I did my best to try and pick something, because that one I did, we had like they were having a choir camp and I had the day to work with them. So I was like, okay, I don't really have time to do a couple back and forths and ask them what they want. I really have to come with a story. So I had gone ahead of time and I thought, you know, this is a book this age group reads. This is a story that I think is universal enough and will fit with their concert. So that was pretty. I did the research ahead and made that decision, but I think it worked out well because they really enjoyed it.
That's great. Have you done anything collaborative with older students or adults where they've been able to contribute musically or improvise in workshops or something?
Yeah. So since the pandemic, I've done a lot more. So for example, Sonic Time Lapse Project, which I know Laura will have already talked about on the podcast.
Laura Hawley and I talked about that in the first episode.
Yeah. So that piece or that is an example of one that I've done where you collect material from singers, reflections or whatnot, and you use that to inspire the piece. So it's sort of an interesting way, and I think way that works very well in times of lockdown to collect material, because it can be very hard to do that virtually. So you could get anything from, you know, little collages of things, collages of quotes, poetry, journal entries, pictures, you know, things people have drawn, and finding ways to incorporate that into the piece. So that I actually really loved. That was my push. I was like, we have to do this. It'll be so cool if we can find a way to just let people express themselves in whatever they want, way they want, but still feel part of the process. So,
So like when you say collecting things, like what sort of, what does your collection look like once?
Yeah. So for this particular one, we asked people to create a reflection early in it. It was, we had this wheel of emotions basically to get people started, and they choose one emotion. I'm blanking right now. Let's say maybe joy or something like that. And then pick one contrasting emotion. And so this wheel sort of had contrasting emotions on the other side. So if you need a little bit of help, you could go on the other side and you might say frustration or grief or something like that, and find these two contrasting emotions. Write that word on one side or each of those words on one side of a blank piece of paper, and then fill that paper in whatever way you want. And that was the challenge. Yeah. So at the beginning, we had conductors doing this, and it was very self-led. But afterwards, Laura and I put together a little bit of a workshop leading people through the process of like visualization, a little bit of lyric writing and whatnot, so people could have some ideas of different things they could do. But I'm a big fan of leaving those things very open, because I love to see what people will do. I'm always surprised and amazed, especially with young people, the things they will do, you know, if they have that initiative, but I leave them the space to do what they want to do.
If the task is clear and the purpose of why they're doing it is clear, it is amazing how they will, what they will come up with. But you seem to have a real gift for structuring and having a clear concept, which is, I find I have to work at that. Like I come in, I'm a convoluted thinker, and I have to bring it, just bump my mic. I'm going to say that again. I find that I'm a convoluted thinker. When I do things like this, I have to work it down, whittle it down into a simpler idea. Mm-hmm. But I'm impressed that you're kind of starting with a clarity of idea.
Oh, no.
That seems to really inspire people to contribute.
Oh, well, I'm glad. I mean, I feel like it's something I'm still working on and getting a sense of. I feel like you just have to be very open and I guess receptive and willing to change things a little bit on the fly. Like, for example, I was just basically putting the finishing touches on a piece right now for the Youth Chorale of Central Minnesota. And this is a piece I'd agreed to doing basically right around slash a couple weeks before the pandemic had hit. So the original idea was not to do anything pandemic related. But then when everything had sort of slowed down, I got very interested in doing things that were more community oriented. And I said, how would you feel if I came in and like did a couple sessions with the group, figure out what they're interested in, because this is like high school students, figure out what kind of a piece they want to have. And so I basically went in like very openly and was like, what kind of a piece do you want to sing? What kind of a piece do you think the world needs right now? And they went into their own breakout rooms, they brainstormed this stuff, they talked about past pieces that they loved, kinds of things they'd love to see in a piece, things they want to hear. And I went from there. I sort of whittled things down a little bit more. I came back for another session with some more specific questions. But we ultimately ended up creating a piece about hope for the future, a piece about resilience. They wanted something to give a break to themselves and the world with everything we're dealing with right now. So something just like contagiously, I don't know if positive is the right word, but inspiring. hopeful, showing the resilience of the human spirit. And so, yeah, that was sort of the theme that they wanted. And I gave them a bunch of prompts about hope is. So I said, hope feels like. And then they gave me a whole bunch of metaphors for what it feels like. Hope sounds like. And like different things like that. So I'd give them the beginning of different sentences. And the verses of the piece actually ended up sort of going along with that. And the I think the opening lyrics is, can you hear it? Like a wave crashing along the shore. And that's one of the metaphors that I'd gotten from the students. Can you see it in the rising sun? And so these are just like various metaphors that I had tied in that I'd gotten from my sessions with them, which is pretty cool.
And does that affect the kind of music you'll write? Like, will you approach setting those lyrics with those images in mind and trying to get that imagery into the music?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that first line especially, like that was one of my favorite lines that I'd found in the metaphor, or sorry, not metaphors, the reflections, the prompts that I had collected from them, is this idea of a wave crashing along the shore. So the entire piece has this sort of rhythmic backing, because they also said they wanted something rhythmic, driving, a little bit of body percussion as well. So the backing is like this, it's like da 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 da. It's like a little bit like a wave, like it's constant, but the dynamics sort of swell and decay, and it has this sort of nice, constant, but urging energy, I guess. And that's sort of inspired from the images that they'd given me about what hope is to them, what resilience is to them.
Right.
So, yeah.
So they're not writing the music in an immediate sense with you, but they are creating the kind of kernel of inspiration.
Yeah, they're creating the inspiration. And I mean, and for this group in particular as well, because we had had that early session about discussing what they wanted in a piece, and they're at a level, you know, they're in high school, they have some musical terminology, they could say things like, you know, we want an up-tempo piece, we want a piece that involves body percussion, we want something that's rhythmic, we want something that, you know, lets the tenors and basses show off their melodic chops or whatever. Like, they could be a little bit more specific about the things they wanted.
Totally. And you know, and this is something you can actually do very quickly in one session with them, that actually gives them a lot of input, and very clear input too. Like, they, because you can go back and just very tangibly say, yeah, you know, this is how I incorporated the parameters that you helped me set. Yeah, this also kind of ties back, for me, to what you were saying in the beginning about having a clear sort of emotion you're trying to get across, and then letting singers help you get that emotion across. Well, in this case, you're maybe leaving a little bit open, like what is hope, and you're letting them refine that definition and of that emotion or that emotional world for you, and then handing it back to you, and then you create a piece. So yeah, I can see how that could really affect what the piece will sound like without them writing a note.
Exactly. Yeah,
which is not a type of collaboration I'd considered.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's cool. I think honestly, I ended up going this route unintentionally because the pandemic hit, and it's just been very hard to go the route. Like, I'm a trained improviser. I would love to, you know, go back and forth a lot with individual singers, have them sing something to me and be able to incorporate those melodies, but it's difficult. And so it's been sort of an interesting workaround way during the pandemic to engage people's creativity in another way. Basically, them giving me almost like a recipe for a piece, you know, in this sense, or giving me the seeds of inspiration, and then me being able to go back to them and say, like, you know, this thing that you just jotted down that you didn't think much about, like, this inspired this entire section or whatever, or this melodic line or whatever, which is really cool to see, because I think it's also an interesting way to connect choristers and students with composers, for them to see how they actually work with material, where they get inspiration, how they find something as simple as a word or an idea, and then imagine that musically.
Yes, and it's also an opportunity to teach young people that process exists in the arts, because we're so used to product. We can buy or stream the products of musical creativity and don't get a window on the process that much. So I think it's any window you can give them is fantastic.
Oh gosh,
like you can tell them about creative process till you're blue in the face, but if you lead them through it or show them how you go through it, it wakes it right up.
No, I've been doing a couple of workshops more recently on like graphic scoring. And I did one recently that was sort of, it was called Composing Aleatoric Music, and it was with Brock University. And it was about my process and approach to composing aleatoric music. But as part of that, I did a workshop with them. So I led them through how I composed Fire, and I sort of showed them, because I have this approach where I will basically almost do like a graphic score of my piece mm-hmm. before I actually write any notes. And I'll be like, okay, here's the plan for my piece. Here's the graphic score. Here's the energy shape. Here's some scribbles or whatever, a graphic score, a version of my piece. And then I'll actually go to writing. So I showed them that, and they basically created their own graphic scores about a river. And it was the coolest mm-hmm. thing. And they went about, and then I got them in breakout rooms, and they were talking about things like, oh, well, my river goes around a bend like this. And so the music gets quieter. And then I imagine some interweaving lines. And right. I was like, wow, like they're totally. Already thinking
rivers
about this
are a
thing.
Great metaphor yeah. for music. Because, and it also, oh, that's great. I should use that.
Yeah.
Because sometimes when you teach graphics course, it's very easy for students to get stuck into a like pitch over time thing, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Your Y axis and your X axis. But a river makes you read the forward path in a different way because it can bend.
The way I sort of got that idea, because I mean, I'm the same, that when you study graphic scores, you do tend to very much get like, you know, the line goes up, the pitch goes up, which is a good idea, yeah. especially for when people are starting out. But yeah. I had done a lot of poetry and creative writing workshops throughout the pandemic. There's been like a lot of stuff mm-hmm. like that Rupi Kaur, for example, has done just like on her Instagram Live. And she's done a lot of amazing like visualization exercises, for example, which is, mm-hmm. I realized sort of what I do in a way when I'm at the early stages of my piece is I sit there and I imagine, and then I think about what that might look like, what that might sound like, and then I create my graphic score. And so I actually lead them through that process when they're creating their graphic score. So, you know, the first step is to actually have them close their eyes and imagine their river, think about it in yep. detail, and to do that. And it was just like, I think it hit home for them, and it also helped a lot of people who are more visual thinkers or who hadn't thought about themselves as people who could be composers to realize, hey, this is actually really approachable. It's not just about me looking at an empty piece of staff paper and being like, where do I even start?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, people are natural storytellers. Mm-hmm. And once you give them the framework that we're telling a story on this piece of paper mm-hmm. And ultimately the music that helps. So how do we get more young people composing? I think we've touched on this a little bit, but like what's something you could... What should be done with them to get them to want to compose more on their own? What's the secret?
I think to just start tying it in with things that are already being done, to be honest. You know, when they're doing, an easy one would be when theory, your training, when they're looking at pieces, just as an extension of, you know, like, did they just learn how to do staccato? Ask them if they want to show you, like, make a short thing, like a 30-second thing using staccato. Did they just learn, you know, major scales or whatever it is, mm-hmm. Or a certain chord, or what else could it be? Maybe even a piece, a specific piece, and say, oh, did you notice that this piece has, you know, an ABA form, or did you notice that it's a waltz or something? Would you like to right. experiment creating your own, like, because then you can go back actually with an analysis kind of framework and teach people to look at pieces and model after those.
Yes.
Which I think is one of the first steps. Yeah.
And you're tying theory to practice then.
Exactly.
Analysis to creation rather than just like something we study in isolation.
Yeah.
I like to tell students that music theory needs a rebrand.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's nothing theoretical about it. It's, mm-hmm. well, pretty much all of it is very practical, or was at some point, mm-hmm. you know. Okay, so here's sort of like if we could bend the laws of space and time, and you could get every music student in Canada or in the world in front of you at once, you're teaching a workshop to all of them at once, what is one skill or concept or philosophy you would want them all to learn?
I think being a self-starter, I would say, and connected to that, having always having a learning mindset, I guess. I feel like those fall in the same kind of realm for me. So having that initiative to take the first step, to say to your teacher, this in particular, I really connected with. Can we do more of this? Because I think you can get the most out of your lessons, your teaching, the things you're doing, if you're willing to be a little bit more vocal about the things you're mm-hmm. doing. And I mean, I think that was important for me because I was always very shy growing up. And so I just sort of do what the teacher was doing, but it's so helpful. I mean, I know now from the other side, from also being a teacher, when students say, I really connect with this, because then you can really help them on their own journey. And I think not just as, you know, a composer, but as a musician, as a person, helping them towards getting to where they want to go, but then also having that mindset still in your brain as you get older and with all the things you do in your life, to just know that you're always learning and to be mm-hmm. humble and to mm-hmm. keep staying curious and keep learning. So,
yeah, something can creep in, particularly in the teenage years and the 20s, where they feel like you have to be good at something. You have to be born good at something somehow.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't go through the process. And
yeah, I think
it's hard. I found I had to unlearn some of that for whatever reason.
Exactly, yeah. So I think it's just important to remember that there's always more to learn. You know, even the people we consider the masters, they were always learning throughout their life and their career. They're always experimenting, doing new things, changing. There's many things they didn't know. So I think it's just realizing that we're all human, and to not put so much pressure on yourself and to learn what you can learn and explore. And if you're creating music, create the music that you like. If you're just making music, mm-hmm. make music that you like. If you're doing something completely different, you know, baking bread or whatever, bake the bread that you like.
That's a good message. The thing I always want to know from everybody, not just composers, is what is your favorite non-musical sound? Your favorite noise or like sound in the world?
I think right now I'm just going to say a cat purring, because I have two cats and their purrs are just, or does that count as musical? I don't know.
No, I think that definition's up to you anyway.
Yeah.
So sure.
I'm going to call it as a non-musical sound, but it just, I think especially during the pandemic, just the purrs of cats, my two cats, has just been like, you know, it can interrupt a tense moment. It can, when I'm feeling a little stuck, they just come up there, little balls of endless happiness, and it's just, yeah, so they're great.
I would argue that a purr is more feeling than sound, but it's both. It's
I
like
guess,
a sense,
yeah.
It's a whole sensation bundle.
That's probably why I like it. I mean, after this whole conversation you can get, I'm a very like visceral kind of feeling-y, intuitive-y person, so that's probably why I like it. It is a sound, but it's also a feeling, because I know the cat's happy and, you know, they're content, and it makes me content because it's just contagious, so... Yeah, cats.
That's great. Okay, final rapid fire. Like, what's your go-to listen? Let's say, okay, I'll frame this intuitively, emotionally, since that seems to be your zone. When you're feeling like spent or down, or like you need to put yourself back together emotionally, is there an album or even just a track or a song that you can listen through and it will heal you and set you back on a good path?
Ooh, for me, I think it would probably be, so I listened to a lot of Regina Spektor growing up, especially in those years, you know, teenage years where a lot's changing. You start sort of struggling and questioning things and there's a lot happening. So I think for me, it would probably be Regina Spektor's album Far. Yeah, there's so much on there. My favorite album.
Does it have a really nice sort of arc to it?
Yeah, it has a really nice arc. And it was one of the first, you know, concerts that I went to that I remember going live, like begging my mom to drive me to Toronto and just literally being there with my mom, who didn't know this music at all, because I just loved it so much, and just watching her play live. And she even would, you know, improvise things between. And she made these silly songs, like her name's Regina Spektor, but she had this song called Reginasaurus, where she sings about herself being a dinosaur. It was just very quirky and weird and authentic. And I really love that. It was just very her, and I could feel that. And I think I connected with that because, I mean, I was a singer-songwriter at the time, but I also was thinking about how that could play out in my own music and how I could let me out, I guess, in a way, in my own music, and that'd be okay. So I was lucky that at the time, you know, there was already like videos and stuff of her and like radio interviews and stuff like that. So I could feel like I was getting to know her as a human in a way. And maybe that's what it was. It was the first artist where I wasn't just listening to their music, but I was also getting to know them in a way. And her music is also the kind of music where you also feel a little bit like you're getting to know her in a way, because she's very quirky. So I just love that. I was like, she's just very her in her music. And it made me feel like it was okay to just be me and be weird and wonderful and wacky. So yeah,
we're gonna lead out with your music. So you've sent me a piece called All Together We Are Love, and the video, the particular recording we're gonna share, what I'll do is I'll share this video of the Canterai Choral Society singing it, because they did, like, you know, like a pandemic, everyone at home, multi video. Those are hard to make, and this one looks really great. Please tell us about this piece. Why'd you write it? How did they end up doing it as an online thing? And what are you trying to get across with this music?
Yeah, so this piece I originally wrote in 2017, I think it was. Yes, 2017, for Elector Women's Choir. So they have a biannual choral leadership workshop for young women. And this is actually my first big girl commission that I got. So it's an important piece to me, but I applied for... Elektra had basically put out this call where they said, we're looking for emerging women composers to create a commission specifically for this workshop. There's going to be a bunch of young women. It's going to be an educational piece. These are the kinds of themes we want to hit, you know, like empowerment, connecting. It's something that we can all learn during that day and sing together at the end, and everyone can take home and work on and perform on their own. It'll be the piece for these people who participated, basically. And so I put together a proposal and I got chosen for that, which is super amazing. I only moved to Vancouver shortly before, ended up connecting with Morna and sort of getting to know her for the first time a little bit more. She's fantastic.
She is. Yeah.
And
you and I mm-hmm. are together, have worked on a project for Elektra that also got postponed.
Exactly. Yeah. The Lost Words, which is mm-hmm. coming up. So, I mean, you can poke around on Elektra's website to find out a little bit about that one, because that's a really exciting project involving 10 Canadian composers.
Yes, I should use, I will plug it while not sounding like I'm plugging myself.
Yeah, it's both of us you're plugging.
Yes. Yeah, and I hope eventually we'll get to, you know, do that. Mm. But yeah, so you wrote this in the workshop for them, and did they premiere it then?
Yeah, so it was sort of, the piece was intended to be a gift for those participating. So at the very end, they didn't really perform it. There was no performance, but they all read it together. Okay. So I have the recording, I think somewhere on my website, of the reading from the very end of that day. I didn't call it a premiere because there wasn't a public performance. Right. And I think the groups, a number of them had went off and performed it that spring after it as part of their own concert. So there was a premiere, but it wasn't really written for the premiere. It was written to be part of that learning experience, which is, I think, part of the reason that I thought it was interesting to actually share as part of this, because this is all about educational yes. music and learning and everything. And that was something I had thought about a lot in this piece. And when I was speaking with Morna, I mean, we sort of outlined some of the topics we wanted to cover, some of the things, you know, empowerment was a big one, creativity, inspiration, those kinds of things. So I worked that into the music, but also finding an interesting way to explore the technique, maybe not technique, to explore aleatory or introduce it to people who hadn't been introduced to it before. So the middle section mm-hmm. of the piece has just some very basic introductory aleatory in it, meant as an accessible introduction to the people who have never done it before.
Great. So this piece ties into everything we've been talking
yes,
about.
Yes, exactly. So it has a little bit of everything, so it worked out.
That's great. And then, so this group that's made the video, they're called the...
I think they're Calgary, Mount Royal, Cantare. And they put together the piece in honor of Canada's female healthcare leaders, actually. They have a nice little message that they've written in the YouTube in case people want to read it. But it was in honor of Canada's amazing women that are leading, you know, this health crisis. And I think this came out in the summer at some point, if I remember correctly, but it's just a beautiful tribute, and it's just the women of the choir, because the choir is actually an SATB choir, and they're singing this piece, dedicating it to them, have some nice visuals as well. But yeah, I think it's a very universal message, so this piece works for a lot of different groups and is a good educational one. So yeah.
And that's it for episode 3 of Fresh Sounds, Open Ears. Thanks so much for listening. My name is Alex Eddington. You can find out more about me at alexeddington.com. We are sponsored by the Alliance for Canadian New Music Projects at acnmp.ca. My guest today was composer Katarina Gimmon. She's got a website, katarinagimmon.com. The way you spell her name is K-A-T-E-R-I-N-A. Last name, G-I-M-O-N. Yes, it looks French. Apparently it's Ukrainian, but it's pronounced in a Canadianized way. So it's katarinagimmon.com. You can find the Fresh Sounds Open Ears podcast at anchor.fm. Also on various of your favorite podcast apps, except Apple, hopefully soon. Please subscribe. Please forward episodes around. Please check us out on social media at Instagram, Twitter, Facebook page. And also, if you find us in a podcast app, I hope you don't only subscribe, but you also rate and review us. That helps other people find the show. Thanks so much. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with Daniel Gardner, another composer, and 2 weeks after that with Juliet Palmer. I'm ahead on interviews, but we're still doing a release every 2 weeks on a Friday. All right. Have a wonderful couple of weeks.